Welcome to Hematologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Christopher Flowers, and to begin, Dr. Flowers presented a patient from his practice with mantle cell lymphoma.
So this is a 68-year-old gentleman who was a very avid baseball player. He played college baseball and then went on to play amateur baseball after college and was still playing at age 68 in a league. He initially received therapy with R-CHOP and then went on to a consolidative autologous peripheral blood stem cell transplant when I first saw him, and really experienced an excellent response and had a 7-year remission and disease-free survival. During that period of time, he traveled the world with his wife, set up a baseball league, continued to play baseball during that period, and was actually feeling quite well. Following that 7-year period, he did experience a relapse of his mantle cell lymphoma as a neck lymph node that grew from about a 1 to 1.5 centimeter lymph node when it first presented to about a 3 centimeter lymph node, and then eventually was noted to have other neck lymph nodes and on scans to have abdominal lymphadenopathy. He then became symptomatic with that progression, and we discussed the options for therapy, which was back around 2009, 2010. And at that time, he initiated therapy with bortezomib for his relapse to disease. He stayed on therapy for about 6 months of time, a little bit less than that, with intermittent breaks in therapy because of neuropathy, but eventually stopped therapy and had approximately a 9-month period before he had progression of his disease.
Before you continue, and I know we're going to talk about, you know, ibrutinib and some of the newer things going on, but I'm just kind of curious in terms of your experience with bortezomib and mantle cell. It seems like a lot of people are switching to weekly subcutaneous. Have you done that? And do you see less problems with neuropathy?
So we do. There's clearly substantial evidence from the myeloma population that switching to a weekly schedule reduces neuropathy and switching to subcutaneous use decreases neuropathy. And the same thing is true in mantle cell lymphoma or other lymphoma subsets where you might think about that. At the time he was treated, that was not a treatment option that was considered or really even emerging at the time, but something that I would consider at this point if you were going to use bortezomib in that setting.
And another question related to bortezomib. There is now an approval of bortezomib up front. Maybe you can talk about the data that was behind that and what your take is on it.
So I think the upfront treatment of patients with mantle cell lymphoma now is more confusing than ever. This was a gentleman who was treated with R-CHOP, I think, at the time that he was diagnosed. I think that is probably the one regimen that would be less likely to be used in the modern era. We now have data from the trial that you alluded to comparing R-CHOP to bortezomib and the similar regimen, but dropping the vincristine, the so-called VR-CAP regimen, where bortezomib replaces the vincristine. That trial has shown benefits in terms of response rate and progression-free survival when compared to R-CHOP. There also are data from the Rummel trial comparing bendamustine and rituximab to R-CHOP that showed in the subset of patients with mantle cell lymphoma that there were better progression-free survival for bendamustine rituximab compared to R-CHOP. And there are data from Europe looking at R-CHOP followed by rituximab maintenance that show benefits over R-CHOP alone for those patients where autologous stem cell transplant or more aggressive therapies would not be considered. So at this date and time, just giving R-CHOP as an upfront regimen is not a viable option, but I think any of those three other options for patients that you're not considering autologous stem cell transplant would be potential options in the modern era.
So this patient gets bortezomib. What was next?
So he overall experienced approximately a 9-month period where he had no progression of his disease, but after that period experienced some progression of disease and eventually shortly after symptomatic progression. As I mentioned, his therapy was intermittently given because of some of the neuropathy that he experienced. After that, he went on to receive lenalidomide in a period of time while we're immediately following the approval of that agent for patients with relapsed mantle cell lymphoma. He tolerated that reasonably well with some breaks in therapy due to cytopenias. He initially started at a dose of approximately 20 milligrams and then was reduced to a dose of 15 and then 10 milligrams. And he tolerated the dose of 10 milligrams for some period of time. and went for 14 months on that agent before he developed symptomatic progression of disease, and then went on to receive ibrutinib following its approval in mantle cell lymphoma, and has been on that treatment for about 9 months now, and it continues to do well.
He's actually responded?
He's responded. He's had reduction of peripheral lymph nodes that were evaluable, and still has some small internal lymph nodes, predominantly in his chest and a few in his abdomen, that are minimal in size.
So any tolerability issues?
So he's tolerated ibrutinib extraordinarily well. He's had some mild to moderate grade 1 bruising that's been experienced. He had a tooth extraction during a period of time and needed to go off therapy briefly. He had a cardiac catheterization while he was on therapy and needed to go off therapy briefly for that procedure as well. And with some of those intermittent breaks in therapy, he has had interval flares where you could see lymph nodes that were starting to regrow, but then went back on therapy and tolerated therapy well and had shrinkage of his lymph nodes again.
Wow, I haven't heard that one before. So you stop it for a week and the nodes start growing?
So his break for his cardiac catheterization was a little bit longer than what you usually would give for a week. He was off therapy for probably about 2.5 weeks, and he did notice, at least in some of his neck lymph nodes, that there was at least mild increase in the size of those lymph nodes. With restarting the therapy, those went back down again.
Wow, interesting. And you mentioned he had bruising. Where was it, and what did it look like?
This was mostly peripheral bruising. As I mentioned, he was still a pretty avid baseball player, even now into his 70s, and I think he was sliding into second base at some point in time and had lower extremity bruising, but he also had some spontaneous bruising overlying his forearms as well. This was really a nuisance to him, probably of more concern to his wife than it was to him.
That's interesting. Have you seen serious bleeds?
I personally haven't had patients with serious bleeds. I have heard just recently from a community provider that refers patients to our practice of a patient that he was treating out in the community with ibrutinib that had an intracranial bleed while on therapy, and that's something that has been reported. In the reported literature, the majority of those serious bleeding events happen with patients that were on anticoagulants early on in the experience with ibrutinib, and so Coumadin is definitely a drug that should be contraindicated for use with ibrutinib. I think what's less clear is other anticoagulants, what the role should be for management of concurrent conditions that need anticoagulation for patients that would be considered for ibrutinib. In general, I tend to shy away from this agent given the other alternatives when oral anticoagulation in particular is needed.
What is your understanding of the pathophysiology of why you see bleeding with ibrutinib, and can you explain, for example, why, more problematic to use Coumadin than other anticoagulants?
Yeah, that is really unclear at this point. That is not well teased out. Presumably, this is due to some off-target effect. We would not expect the Bruton's tyrosine kinase to be present in areas that might affect bleeding diathesis. The other thing that complicates this picture is many of these patients are also thrombocytopenic, either from their prior therapies or from their disease. And so that oftentimes makes the understanding of bleeding, particularly in CLL patients, another patient population where ibrutinib is commonly used, it makes it much more complicated.
What would you be thinking about if this man has progressive disease next?
So there are a number of clinical trials that we have discussed over time for patients with relapsed mantle cell lymphoma and discussed with him in particular. I think another agent that looks to be quite intriguing in this patient population is the BCL2 inhibitor, ABT-199. We will have a protocol that's opening in the future that's actually looking at the combination of ibrutinib and ABT-199 that I think would be quite intriguing. That trial will allow patients who have previously failed ibrutinib to go on, and so that would be the kind of therapy that I would think about for him. There are other chemotherapy agents that he has not had that are active in lymphomas broadly and active in mantle cell lymphoma. In particular, bendamustine rituximab would be one that would be an option for him. He has had a fair number of lines of therapy, and so I'd be more concerned about cytopenias in that particular situation. But when you look at his care over the period of time that I described, he had R-CHOP up front and then had an autologous stem cell transplant, and that happened approximately 9.5 to 10 years ago, with all the therapies that he's had in the intervening time, none of those have been chemotherapy-based agents. And so while we are quite concerned with giving more chemotherapy as the fourth or fifth line of therapy, he's having a fourth or fifth line of therapy where three of those intervening lines were not chemotherapy-based approaches. So that may be less of a concern in his case.
You mentioned the fact this man's had a protracted course. What do you see in terms of survival in mantle cell nowadays, and particularly in an older patient like this one?
So with the multitude of agents that we have for use in the relapse setting for mantle cell lymphoma, I think we're seeing longer and longer survivals with this disease. Mantle cell lymphoma is also complicated because there is a subset of this disease that have a very protracted survival regardless of what you do, and some of those patients can even be observed initially. And there are experimental approaches, at least at this point, at giving less intensive therapy regimens, in particular chemotherapy-free regimens. There is a regimen looking at lenalidomide plus rituximab that is being used in the upfront setting. And there are also less intensive chemotherapy-based approaches, one that's been put forward in particular by Mitch Smith, looking at using a bendamustine rituximab backbone and adding bortezomib in the frontline setting to that in a randomized fashion, and looking at lenalidomide maintenance in that setting in a randomized fashion, which may also be able to prolong survival for these patients without the intensive approaches that I described, like autologous stem cell transplant.
What is your current approach to sequencing agents? This man, because of the fact that he was, you know, diagnosed a while back, you know, it affected the sequence he got in terms of what was available. But nowadays, particularly in terms of bortezomib, lenalidomide, and ibrutinib this man received, usually right now, how are you sequencing them?
So I think that's a very complicated discussion to have with patients. Typically, I tend to give the most effective and most active agent first, which is ibrutinib, which has the highest complete response rate and overall response rate and produces prolonged progression-free survival. But when I have this discussion with patients, we do have substantial data to suggest that there is a role for lenalidomide for patients who have relapsed after bortezomib based on the eMERGE trial that led to the approval of that agent. And we have data for the use of ibrutinib in patients who have relapsed after bortezomib and lenalidomide. So we know how the most effective agent works after the other two agents have been used. What we know less well is how well lenalidomide works after ibrutinib or how bortezomib works after ibrutinib. And sequencing in that way can be more challenging.
So you mentioned ABT-199, now known as venetoclax. Can you talk about the mechanism of action of this agent, what's been seen in terms of efficacy, not just with mantle cell, but other B-cell cancers, and what the rationale is to combine it with ibrutinib in this study?
So venetoclax is an agent that blocks, or is an inhibitor of BCL2. BCL2 is a protein that is seen commonly in lymphoid cells and in lymphoid malignancies that inhibits the process of apoptosis. And what venetoclax does is it allows cells to go through apoptosis. And in particular, there is profound work by Tony Letai's group that suggests that venetoclax, when used in combination with chemotherapy, actually helps the chemotherapy to push cells through the process of apoptosis. So there were data that were presented at the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting with further follow-up at the lymphoma meeting in Lugano, looking at the combination of bendamustine rituximab and ABT-199 or venetoclax that shows in a phase one setting fairly impressive response rates and tolerability in patients with a number of lymphoma subsets. In particular, in follicular lymphoma, this looks to be quite active, and how active it will be in other lymphoma subsets, I think, remains to be seen. But that appears to be quite an active combination. To your question about ibrutinib, there are preclinical data that suggests that the B-cell receptor inhibitor ibrutinib and ABT-199 or venetoclax interact to help to promote this process, apoptosis. And so that is at least compelling in vitro data that we hope to test in a clinical trial moving forward.
What specifically has been the activity of venetoclax by itself in mantle cell?
So In mantle cell lymphoma as a single agent, it appears to have meaningful single agent activity. And in combination, we're hopeful that combined activity will be even greater.
And I guess this agent also is on a fast-tracked or accelerated approval in CLL17P. What about the issue of tumor lysis syndrome? This has been discussed. I'm not sure if they've sort of figured out a way around that at this point.
So that is a very serious issue. I think in the early days of testing and exploration of venetoclax, particularly in the CLL population, this is an oral agent that is used kind of similar to other oral agents are used, like ibrutinib or lenalidomide or chlorambucil. And so the early management of those patients was to give the patient the oral agent and to see them back in days or weeks, which turned out not to be the right approach. And for those patients, some of those early patients experienced tumor lysis syndrome, and even some of those patients died because of tumor lysis syndrome. Now the management strategy for patients on the clinical trial that I mentioned with bendamustine rituximab or in the low-grade lymphomas and for single agent venetoclax and CLL is to admit all patients for cycle number one, to give them aggressive hydration, to follow them closely for tumor lysis syndrome. And for those patients who experience tumor lysis syndrome with cycle number one, to continue to admit them for subsequent cycles of therapy as tumor lysis syndrome continues to occur. In our experience with the trial that I mentioned using rituximab, bendamustine, and venetoclax, what we found in lymphoma patients is that we tend to admit patients for cycle number one. They do not experience tumor lysis syndrome with aggressive hydration. And then for all subsequent cycles, they're able to tolerate that regimen as an outpatient.
Do you think that's kind of the way it's going to be, or do you think we'll be able to move towards outpatient hydration?
My hope is that eventually what we'll be able to define are better risk strata, that there are some patients that will be still at high risk for tumor lysis syndrome and will need this process of admission to occur, but hopefully many more patients where we can define who are at lower risk of tumor lysis syndrome and all their patient care can occur in the outpatient setting. And that's one of the things that these early trials hope to define. In the CLL trial in particular, we're starting to risk stratify patients into different strata of tumor lysis risk. And as those strategies emerge, we will be able to hopefully treat some of those patients initially in the outpatient setting.
So let's talk about your patient with follicular lymphoma.
Sure. So this is a gentleman who was diagnosed in his late 60s. This was approximately 10 years ago. He initiated therapy after a period of about 2 years of watchful waiting with CVP-based chemotherapy. He tolerated that therapy quite well and went into remission for about 2 years, where he had a partial remission during that period of time. He discussed with his provider at that time the potential role for rituximab maintenance and elected not to have rituximab maintenance during that time frame. He relapsed, as I mentioned, about 2.5 to 3 years after CVP, where his relapse eventually became progression of disease that was substantial enough to need additional therapy. He went on to single-agent rituximab and had 4 weekly doses, again had a partial response. That partial response lasted approximately 2.5 to 3 years before the progression became symptomatic enough to him with fevers and night sweats to need additional therapy. He went on then to have radioimmunotherapy at that time period and had a subsequent response to therapy, and that remission lasted approximately 3 years when he first came to see me.
So before you talk about how you thought through that situation, it's interesting he had such a good response to radioimmune therapy. Do you utilize this strategy? I kind of always have been surprised that it never, sort of got in the middle of everything.
To me, that's one of the most surprising issues in the management of follicular lymphoma. If you ask patients about radioimmunotherapy, it's the kind of strategy that they would enjoy pursuing. It's the kind of therapy where they typically come in now for just one-time dosing of therapy. They don't have to come back for serial infusions, and then they have to come back in a period of time between about 4 and 12 weeks for serial blood count checks to make sure that they're not thrombocytopenic and need transfusions. But for the most part, it's a therapy that is tolerated quite well. Overall, though, when you look at radioimmunotherapy use across the United States, it is very infrequently used. And so, to my mind, it's probably two of the most effective therapies in follicular lymphoma that are almost never used and reasonably well tolerated. And that part of it remains a little bit of a mystery. Part of it that has to do with the way that it's administered. It's commonly administered by nuclear medicine specialists who don't do this on an everyday basis. They might treat patients with iodine-131 radiation therapy for thyroid cancer, but by and large, they're folks that are reading PET scans and managing other nuclear medicine studies and not providing therapies to patients. And as a result, the stocking and storage of this therapy and the manufacturer consequently is more challenging and has really not made it in a broad spread fashion to the follicular lymphoma marketplace, now to the point where these therapies really are not used much at all in the United States.
Does that include you?
So I probably use more radioimmunotherapy than anybody else in the state of Georgia, and I probably use it once or twice a year.
Interesting. So what happened? This man had a great response for 3 years. It's incredible. And then what?
So he had an incredible response to that. He went on a series of clinical trials, mostly with short-lived responses, about 3 trials in all. He was a serial trialist and went on to a clinical trial in Washington with Ollie Press, went on to another clinical trial at MD Anderson, and then came to our institution to enroll on a clinical trial with idelalisib.
Yeah, I was thinking, as you were telling the story, I'm thinking, when's the idelalisib coming in? So he goes on a trial. That was idelalisib alone or with R?
So he went on idelalisib alone as a single agent.
Which, of course, is the way it's approved, although somehow I'm not sure exactly why, but you tell me.
So that's a little bit of a confusing story. So idelalisib for patients with follicular lymphoma and indolent lymphomas is an agent that is used as a single agent, whereas in CLL, it's commonly used with rituximab. Some of that may be an artifact of the design of the clinical trials, where in the CLL space, it was compared to single-agent rituximab, and so idelalisib plus rituximab was compared to rituximab, and so consequently, that became the approved regimen in CLL. In indolent lymphomas, there was a broad-ranging trial that used idelalisib as a single agent, where it produces response rates.
So how long ago was this that he went on the study?
So he initiated this study approximately 2.5 years ago and is still on therapy.
I was going to say, and he responded, but he had some diarrhea.
So he did respond, and he did have some diarrhea. So he's had kind of 2 different kinds of diarrhea. He had an initial diarrhea that some patients have experienced as an acute reaction to the drug with initiation. That's a kind of diarrhea that typically, if you stop the drug or hold it, that the diarrhea goes away and then you could restart the drug and the diarrhea typically doesn't occur. He also, around that same period of time, had some rises in his LFTs that likewise resolved with stopping the drug and with restarting the drug didn't recur. But then approximately 9 months after being on therapy, 6 to 9 months after being on therapy, he experienced diarrhea again that kind of progressively worsened and then worsened to the point that even with stopping the drug, it still occurred. This tends to be a more inflammatory diarrhea that occurs later, and he was initiated on steroids, and that resolved his diarrhea. He's had 2 to 3 more bouts sort of similar to that that also resolve with steroids.
You know, I was sort of, I don't know, being flippant and saying about the diarrhea, but do most patients have some kind of diarrhea or most do not?
I would say most patients do not have diarrhea, but it's quite common. So somewhere in the range of 30 to 40% of patients in the trials have experienced some diarrhea.
Other than that, any quality of life issues with idelalisib?
For the most part, for this patient and for other patients that I've treated with this agent, it is one that is reasonably well tolerated. As I mentioned, that it can affect the liver function tests. Usually these patients don't get much in the way of cytopenias from the drug. It can cause some fatigue, but usually that is reasonably well tolerated.
So what do you do with patients who get BR, plus or minus maintenance R, and then have a relapse? What's your next therapy?
So for many of those patients, those would be the types of patients in our practice that would go on a phase 1 or phase 2 clinical trial for follicular lymphoma. And there are a number of new agents that are proceeding in that space. So we've talked a little bit about ibrutinib as a Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor and the first in its class. We've talked about idelalisib as a PI3 kinase inhibitor as the first in its class, but they're now what I call son of drugs. So son of ibrutinib and son of idelalisib, where there are many more PI3 kinase inhibitors and BTK inhibitors that can be used in that space and I think should be considered for such patients that may have properties that are better than those approved agents. For patients who would not consider a clinical trial, I think idelalisib is the approved and most reasonable choice for somebody who's relapsed after bendamustine rituximab and rituximab maintenance. So what we've tended to see in practice is that patients who come to us in the relapse setting commonly have had rituximab bendamustine for 6 cycles as their first line therapy and followed that by 2 years of maintenance therapy with rituximab given on a schedule similar to Prima. And when they relapse, then idelalisib is a regimen or drug that I think is important to consider in that setting.
So let's finish out talking about Hodgkin lymphoma. You had a patient you wanted to present?
Sure. So this patient is a young woman with Hodgkin lymphoma who initially presented in her 30s. She actually presented with mediastinal mass and bulky mediastinal mass that was at risk of obstructing her airway and making her short of breath. She had bulky stage 2 disease and was initially treated with ABVD chemotherapy. She achieved a PET negative complete response after 2 cycles of therapy and went on to complete a total of 6 cycles of therapy. One of her particular challenges in her care was concern over the risk of radiation and breast cancer. And she was a woman whose mother had breast cancer and had a maternal aunt that had breast cancer. And ultimately, the patient and her mother were tested and determined to be BRCA1 positive.
Wow.
And so while she had a bulky mass, she was a patient that we discussed very carefully with the radiation doctors whether or not to do radiation therapy. And based on that additional risk and based on the fact that she was PET negative after 2 cycles of therapy, elected not to go on to radiation.
So what's her current situation?
So unfortunately, that was approximately 3.5 years ago, and she experienced relapse of her disease now a little bit less than 3 years afterwards. Again, with initially PET positivity in that mass that had become PET negative, and then went on to receive a biopsy of that ultimately was determined to be Hodgkin lymphoma. She now has completed an autologous peripheral blood stem cell transplant and now at her post-transplant scan 3 months after her transplant is PET negative and complete remission again.
So what about the issue of brentuximab maintenance therapy and the ATHERA trial that was presented looking at that question at the last ASH meeting?
So those are very provocative data. When you look at the ATHERA trial, that showed a benefit in progression-free survival for patients who went on to post-transplant maintenance therapy after autologous peripheral blood stem cell transplant. And that's a strategy that we're considering for her when she comes back for her next visit.
Interesting. Is that something that you've been doing?
It has not been something that we've applied on a regular basis to our patients with Hodgkin lymphoma who relapse after initial therapy, but I think something that needs careful consideration and that we're considering applying to our practice as a whole.
So speaking of Hodgkin lymphoma, one of my favorite, you know, we always like to ask poll questions when we do live events, and one of my favorite new ones is, in which tumor are anti-PD-1 antibodies the most active? And then we list lung cancer, melanoma. Down at the bottom, we put Hodgkin lymphoma. And nobody knows that's the right answer. I think that's the right answer.
And that is very much the right answer.
It seems like it is from what I can tell. And it's pretty much recent news. Can you talk about those data and what you think about it?
So those are very exciting data. So there were 2 back-to-back presentations at this last year's American Society of Hematology meeting looking both at pembrolizumab and looking at nivolumab. We've been involved in one of the follow-up nivolumab trials, and it looks like PD-1 inhibition for patients with relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma is a very active approach. We've even been able to get that agent approved for some patients who relapse outside of a clinical trial now based on those early findings and 2 publications in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Have you seen responses at this point, or are you just starting?
So for our patients that were enrolled on the phase two clinical trial, the majority of those patients have responded. And I think the challenging question for that agent is how long to continue it. The way the trials are designed is that those patients continue on therapy as long as they are responding. The initial way the drug is given is it's given every 2 weeks and then eventually spaced out to give it once a month. And so that requires fairly intensive infusion time for those patients who are on PD-1 antibodies, but it appears to be a very active agent with at least a high overall response rate. So we have, at least in the patients we've treated, we have not seen complete responses yet.
So as you mentioned before, you know, bevacizumab is now being moved up to frontline in trials looking at HL. What about anti-PD-1 antibodies? Is there discussion or are there trials about using it up front?
So I would suspect that that is a direction that this agent may be heading. I think one of the challenges with PD-1 antibodies is that they've been applied in so many different malignancies, as you mentioned. Choosing the right target to pursue as the focus for clinical trials still remains to be seen. In Hodgkin lymphoma, I think there clearly are opportunities for moving those into the earlier lines of therapy. The other avenue that's been explored is looking now at combination therapy. So much like what has been done and been seen in melanoma, where PD-1 antibodies are being applied in combination with other immunotherapies like ipilimumab, we have a trial that is being run through the ECOG and headed by Catherine Diefenbach that has looked at the combination of brentuximab and ipilimumab for patients with relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma. Now that trial is hopefully in the future going to start looking at the combination of ipilimumab and a PD-1 antibody, and potentially in the future looking at the combination of ipilimumab, brentuximab, and a PD-1 antibody.
You know, getting back to this lady, you said she was BRCA1?
Correct. So this lady was BRCA1 positive.
So is she considered a bilateral mastectomy?
So she has. So her mother has already had a bilateral mastectomy. She has elected not to have a bilateral mastectomy at this point.
But at the time she decided to forego radiation therapy, were you taking care of her at that point?
So she was actually being taken care of by another clinician and transferred her care to me after that decision had been made.
So did she know she was BRCA1 at that point?
She knew she was BRCA1 positive at the time that the decision had been made not to give radiation.
So if she had decided to get a bilateral mastectomy, for example, at that point, would you have radiated her?
Yeah, so that was one of the things when she first came to me that we discussed. She had already made the decision not to get a bilateral mastectomy, so that took that off of the table, but that was one of the propositions that I raised. A major concern for her was the size of her initial mass. And as of yet, there are not clear data to suggest that you can use a different strategy for patients who are early PET negative, even though those patients have very favorable outcomes in prior retrospective and prospective studies. We did try to apply those data in her situation to say that she might hopefully fare better without radiation, given kind of all of the concerns available.
What's your current approach right now in terms of people with earlier stage disease about this question of radiation therapy or just chemo alone?
Yeah, so there are a number of different trials out there to address this. There are trials from the Harvard group that suggest that with chemotherapy-based approaches without radiation, that you can have very favorable responses and long-term disease-free survival without relapse. The standard approach has been to give an abbreviated course of chemotherapy followed by radiation. And to my mind, the most compelling data come from the German Hodgkin study group, where they have looked at patients with very favorable early stage disease and found that you can give even very abbreviated chemotherapy, so just two cycles of ABVD, followed by less radiation, just 20 gray of radiation for that most favorable group. And that's tended to be my strategy for the most favorable patients, and to continue to give radiation.